On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Google makes it rain data centers, AT&T throws a tantrum, and Heartbleed demoed. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 88, recorded April 18th, 2014, for April 21st, 2014. Heartbleed? Oops. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. The cloud-based phone system we use just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs and RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but it provides self-help service at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code ENTERPRISE to receive $10 off at checkout. And by TechServe, the world's largest independent Apple retailer and professional services provider. Go to TechServe.com/Twiet-7Sins to get access to the free ebook on the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment. Welcome to TWiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But as always, I am joined by an all-star cast, starting with my good friend, Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise from the University of Hawaii. Brian, how are you today?
I am sore, I am tired, and I'm sunburned. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary for the school, and we even pulled the ROV out of the water along with all our robots. It was awesome.
You are always bragging about your submersibles. You know, I'm going to have to get my own. Forget you. We're done with your Hawaiian submersibles. Now, let's go to a man who I know runs no submersibles on his own, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, good to see you again, my friend. Are you ready for some enterprise?
Absolutely, Padre. It's always a good day for some enterprise, especially on a rainy day here in the Sunshine State.
That's got to rain somewhere. It sure as heck ain't happening in California. Now let's get straight into the enterprise bite. This first one sort of crosses boundaries a little bit because we don't talk a lot about retail, but of course retail for many corporations is the end of the enterprise IT chain. And this is an interesting story. Now, ask not for who the iBeacons, it beacons for your iPhone. You may remember how Apple released iBeacons not too long ago. It's a location technology. Now, it differs from GPS or assisted GPS in that it uses low-power Bluetooth to localize you within an interior or small space. Now, this is perfect for retail spaces because what it allows people to do is to set up sensors in their store so they can figure out where people are congregating. Or in the best case scenario, if someone is hovering over a device, let's say they're looking at a laptop or a desktop or a phone, you can then use some smart intelligence type modules to figure out that that person should receive some sort of coupon, should receive some sort of incentive to buy it now. It's sort of the dream of retailers, and it is interesting technology, but there's always been a problem. The problem has been that if they turn off the app, if they don't have it enabled, well, you can't track them. Now, the people who were making apps were complaining to Apple, so Apple fixed that in the February update of iOS. They actually allowed for what's called delegation of the iBeacon from the marketing app to the iPhone system. It's now run by the operating system, which means it never turns off, which means you can always be tracked, which means that the marketers can always get the big data points that they want. Of course, this has privacy implications back and forth, but Chibert, I want to start off with you first. Let's get past the, oh my God, Apple is tracking us, because I think at this point we know everyone's trying to track us. Everyone's trying to monetize our location. Is this inevitable? I mean, Apple is one of the first to do this and to unabashedly say, yes, this is a feature that we're giving to our partners. But is this something that people are going to push back because of privacy, or something that all the other firms that deal in big data are eventually going to make a move towards?
You know, it's not going to be just Bluetooth. It's definitely, you know, retail analytics can actually track Wi-Fi, even if you're not associated with the device.
Right.
You know, a lot of big marketers are doing that just so they can find out how long are you hovering in front of the storefront before you walk in the door. But there are some less intrusive uses for this type of technology. I actually own a device called a track dot. And it's a little device that I stick into my bags. And as I travel around the country, it will actually tell me when my bags arrive at certain airports. That way I can know, did someone misplace my bag or whatever. You know, Padre, you lose your bags enough that you should get a track dot.
Yeah, and actually, we make a joke about that, but I think you're hitting on something big, and that is I've heard from many people in the tech punditry business that as long as I don't think that they're doing anything nefarious, if I know what they're trying to do, of course they're trying to sell me stuff, but if they give me a service that is worth my while, then I'm happy to let them track me. Curtis, what about that? If you felt bad about your iPhone giving away your location when you're inside of a retail store, would you automatically feel better if suddenly in your email box you got a $50 off coupon for the iPhone that you already wanted to buy?
I think in many cases you would, because for most people, privacy is an asset, and they are perfectly willing to trade that asset for something of value. What they have trouble with is a case where they feel that someone is violating that privacy and essentially giving them nothing of value in return. That's one of the big problems with a lot of what we've heard about the government security and privacy issues. People don't see the privacy intrusions as providing tangible value. That's a problem for government PR. But in the case of retailers, in the case of hoteliers, in restaurants, other companies like that, if they can provide a tangible benefit in return for the privacy, then the customers are, by and large, quite okay with that.
I like that. Tangible benefit. I think that, in essence, that describes all of social. We know we're giving away information when we do Facebook or G+ or Twitter or whatever we use, Instagram, but we get that tangible benefit. And even if we're not making a conscious decision to say, I'm going to give you privacy for this, we become okay with it. Now, in the chat room, we've got a couple of people, Jabba, I see you, who, they're trying to be kind of smug. I know they're joking, but they're saying, oh, this is just Apple trying to get its rich prisoners again to buy stuff. But, T-Bert, back to you. The same question. This isn't just Apple, right? I mean, this is big data. When we talk about the promise of big data, we talk about the quantification of everything, every kind of data point that we can get, and trying to turn it into some sort of reference map so we know which actions lead to which reactions. And again, asking you, is this an Apple thing, or is this Apple the first company that's willing to dare and say, no, we're doing this, this is going to become the norm?
Oh, no. Apple is by far not the first. Like I keep saying over and over, the Wi-Fi vendors have been playing in the retail analytics game a lot longer than iBeacon's been around. You know, this is actually easier to do on Wi-Fi than it is on the Bluetooth, because you've already got the infrastructure. You're providing a tangible benefit to your patrons like Walmart or Kmart or whatever's. They're providing Wi-Fi for their customers so they can tweet or they can snap pictures of this really cool dress or doodad that they found in the store. So they're providing the customers with tangible something or another. But at the same time, the stores want to know, you know, what displays are most effective. Are they standing outside the glass window, you know, window dressings? You know, what's effective, what's not? Because that tells them how to spend, even down to things like how do they move through the store? Because then they might want to rearrange the aisles so that they can more effectively sell you goods and products.
Curtis, I want to give you the last word on this story. In 2 weeks, we're going to have Matthew Gast from Aerohive come back onto the show, and he's been playing with iBeacon, so he's going to show us the full extent of the capabilities of the technology. But let me ask you this. We're talking about retail space right now, but there's this starting rumor, this starting buzz about the possibilities for an iBeacon-like technology, even if, like Chiebert says, it's really just tracking Wi-Fi, within the enterprise, within logistics, within actual corporate buildings. Do you see this sort of tech, this low-energy tracking tech, becoming more vital for enterprise?
Oh, I certainly do. This is the sort of thing you mentioned, logistics. I think in all kinds of areas, this is important. You know, one of the key ingredients in the whole unified communications area is what's called presence, letting people know whether you're available to talk. Now imagine something that let people know not only if you were available to talk, but if you were available for a live meeting, and if so, where that live meeting was. You know, Bob can't come to the phone right now, but he's walking down the hall just outside. You could probably grab him. That's the sort of thing that could be very valuable to the enterprise. You're seeing that in a lot of different areas. I had a conversation with the vice president at MGM talking about what they want to do with high rollers in their casinos, being able to automatically check them in as soon as they come in the door, being able to help give them directions to different places around those sprawling Las Vegas casinos. There are all kinds of applications that have been waiting for this capability, and I think that now that Apple has made it available, we're going to start seeing an explosion in apps that really take advantage of this in what is generally, although not always, a very positive way.
Big brother or little prophet, we'll see. Now let's move on to the next story. Google is making it rain. Data centers. That's right. According to a story from the Register, Google has just outdone themselves with spending on capital outlay, specifically on data centers. Now, we know that last year, Google spent a total for all of 2013 of $7.35 billion on capital outlays. That includes all the work that they did with Google Fiber. In just the first quarter of 2014, they have spent $2.3 billion, and that spending seems to be accelerating. In fact, there are a couple of analysts who are saying they wouldn't be surprised if Google outpaces last year's spending by $1, $2, $3, maybe even $4 billion. We could be seeing them spend $14 billion just to build out their data infrastructure. Now, by comparison, some of Google's biggest big data competitors, Amazon, Microsoft, Cisco. Amazon spent $800 million in the quarter. Microsoft spent $1.7 billion in the quarter. And Cisco spent $100 million in the quarter. So obviously, Google is expanding their already incredibly formidable capital outlay data center connectivity options. Chiebert, let me throw this to you first. Where's this money going?
Oh, great question. And actually, I think I'll answer it by saying that Amazon has a new service. They call it Workspaces. You know what it is? It's a managed desktop. So now, instead of having to maintain the IT infrastructure of your own, say you're a small business, you can just pay the, I think it's the low end is a $50 a month if you're Joe Schmo walking off the street, but you get a full office suite and everything. Managed desktops are a pretty cool thing, and I think, this is my guess, is that Google doesn't want Amazon to rule that market, so they're playing catch-up.
I really like that. That makes sense. But Curtis, let me throw this over to you. Google is outspending by a large margin all of their competition. And as I mentioned before, the data center setup that they had, the multi-colos and the fiber in between them, were already the envy of everybody in the business. So is this a defensive move? I mean, we know that Google wants to get out of just being known as a search company. I mean, for the longest time, they were okay with saying everything we do aims towards search. But now they seem to be heading more into that overall goal of organizing the world's information. And with this kind of expenditure, they're going to have the capability to do it. They're actually outspending the NSA on data centers. So let me ask you, what do you think about Chiebert's theory that this is just a way to make sure that there is no up-and-comer who can challenge them for the throne of managed desktops?
Well, I think the Chiebert's on the right path. I want to throw a couple of other things in there, though, as well. Number one, Google is doing a lot to disrupt the market and make sure they have more customers. Look at what they've done to broadband with Google Fiber. That's been very disruptive. It tends to add Google customers. We're also looking at something that's getting a lot of press now out of the Google X Lab, the idea of the Wi-Fi balloons that would add customers around the world as it spreads Wi-Fi to areas that currently don't have it. Google is looking for ways to bring access to the roughly 75% of the world's population that doesn't have it right now. That requires data, and I think that they're putting data centers in place in anticipation of that. The other thing is that Microsoft has made a major move in its Office 365 by providing Office capabilities on the iPad. Google is going to have to respond by stepping up its game in the whole desktop productivity area, and that includes the managed desktop. So they're looking at doing two things: radically enlarging their customer base and radically increasing the offerings they provide to those customers. Put them together, and it's a recipe that requires lots and lots of new data center capability. I think those are the things that they're looking at as they're looking ahead and trying to put the data center infrastructure in place to meet what they perceive will be the demand in 2 to 5 years.
Cool. Very cool. Very astute. Chibert, let me give you the last word on here. We've got TV's Egon in the chat room who, as long as we're speculating, let's speculate big. He brings up something that I love, which is Google's outlay also in preparation to their continued rollout of Google Fiber and planned cell phone network? We know that Google's been making advances in both sides. They've been rolling out Google Fiber to more and more cities, specifically with the stipulation that we will equip your city if you make it easy for us to do it, if you cut all the red tape. And we know that they've been in talks with some of the major cell phone companies trying to become an MVNO, a mobile carrier, a virtual carrier, to attach towers to fiber that they already own, the backhaul they already own. Is this a plan to support that? I mean, are they thinking that far ahead, saying we want the capability ready to just turn on when it's good to go?
That makes a lot of sense. I've been seeing the snuck out pictures, the leaked pictures of what Google wants to do. They're putting an awful lot of back end processing behind their mobile platforms, you know, from Google Voice to Google Glass and so forth. Now that Google Glass can be bought by anyone off the street that wants to plunk down $1,500, that's an awful lot of back-end processing. So I've got to imagine that as Google expands the intelligence of the mobile device, that they're going to need back-end processing, and they're going to need the back-end processing closer and closer to their patrons.
Let's talk a bit more about patrons as we move on to our third Enterprise Bite, and that is AT&T getting crafty in the new round of spectrum wars, or are they just being AT&T bags? Now, we've got the story straight from the Register again, talking about how the FCC is getting ready to have another round of auctions for the repurposed 600 megahertz spectrum. This is the spectrum that was taken away from broadcast TV. Now, the FCC is hoping to raise $30 billion in the auction, but more importantly, they're placing caps on the amount of spectrum that any single player can buy. The theory is if they spread it out, they can encourage competition by giving smaller carriers the ability to buy in to that spectrum, to that auction, and provide services that are not part of one of the big four. Now, AT&T doesn't like that. They've issued several different letters, open letters, saying this is stupid, we can't do this, you're not giving enough spectrum to fully deploy LTE in the markets that we want to deploy. That didn't get them anywhere, so now they're going to take their ball and they're going to go home. In an open letter from the AT&T Federal Regulatory Vice President Joan March, they have said that they're not going to participate in the auction because they'd rather spend their money elsewhere. Chibert, let me throw it to you first. Is this an actual threat, or is this just bluster and bluffing?
Oh, man, I don't know. This is starting to feel like AT&T wants to be a monopoly again. You know, I'd love to see LTE become more prevalent. You know, Verizon with those stupid maps in the United States and the different colors. The reality is there's an awful lot of people that don't have LTE in their area yet, and you know, is the FCC making that harder to do? or are they just opening competition? I'm not so sure. But keep in mind, LTE requires an awful lot of spectrum to achieve those kinds of speeds. You don't get something for nothing. So maybe, you know, I think I'm going to lean towards the FCC's kind of shooting themselves in the foot and, most importantly, shooting the customers in the foot.
Okay, that's interesting. I like that. We're going to have some dissent here. So T-Bird is basically saying AT&T may have a valid complaint here. I mean, we see what the FCC is trying to do. Theoretically, it could encourage competition, but really all you're doing is you're making sure that no single player can ever buy enough spectrum to really deploy a fast, consistent, comprehensive, high-speed LTE network. Let me throw this over to you, Curtis. We have a quote here from Joan March. That's, again, the AT&T, they have a department for this, the AT&T Federal Regulatory Vice President. She says, if the restrictions as proposed are adopted, AT&T will need to seriously consider whether its capital and resources are directed towards other spectrum opportunities that will better enable AT&T to continue to support high-quality LTE network deployments to serve its customers. So what they're saying is, hey, FCC, we know you want to raise $30 billion. We know that we were going to have to pony up that big $30 billion. Either you play it our way, or you're going to make a lot less money in the spectrum auction. Do you see that as a real threat?
Well, here's what I think. I would love to think that we were going to get much better competition if they keep the caps in place. And in general, I'm in favor of greater competition, more players in the market. I think it would be thrilling if somebody like T-Mobile or maybe even Sprint came in and said, we'll take that. We'll up our game. We'll make everything better. The reality is that what we've seen in the market is companies going in, taking advantage of the spectrum auctions, buying up the spectrum, deploying it, and then being bought by one of the big two or three cell players anyway. So I fear that what's going to happen is that rather than increasing competition, we're simply going to delay the access to that spectrum by one of the big cellular providers anyway. If I were the FCC, I would keep the restrictions in place and see what I could do. I don't think that AT&T should be out there bullying people. And if they really think that there's other spectrum that they'd rather develop, more power to them.
Chibet, I've heard this before. They're in the blogosphere, there are people who are saying, wait a minute, doesn't matter what the FCC does with the spectrum auction. If these smaller players buy the spectrum, they're going to try to use it. They're going to fail because they don't have the backhaul that one of the big four have. And ultimately, they're going to end up selling their spectrum to one of the big players. So all we're doing is delaying the deployment of a comprehensive LTE network that's going to be a monopoly. And, oh, well, I guess that's just the way it's going to be. Do you follow that fatalistic tone? Or do you say, look, maybe we could develop something else. Maybe the FCC is going to put in some stipulations that say you can't just sell the spectrum. If you don't use it, it comes back to us.
You know, I'd almost like to see some of the promise of the original research on networking where everything was over wireless to begin with. You know, heck, the AlohaNet project was wireless. I keep thinking, you know, gee, how nice it would be if the FCC would go and say, hey, we're going to make this giant block of spectrum available, and we're going to chop it up into a whole bunch of channels so that you can still achieve LTE speeds, but you have to coordinate over this, you know, special wired internet. And the various players that want to play, big and small, can offer up services in that spectrum in a particular area. And so instead of licensing spectrum, you license areas within the spectrum. It's going to be a lot harder to manage. But gee, wouldn't it be great if I had one mobile device in one frequency range that I could roam all over the United States and be able to use the spectrum? That, you know, I think I'm being really, really idealistic. I don't think it's going to happen. I think technologically it can be done. I just don't think any of the big players want to see that happen, because then that removes a lot of differentiation between the products.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on the story as it develops. When we come back, we're going to be going deep into Heartbleed. I know we talked about it briefly in the last episode, but we've got a special guest, Mr. Raphael Mudge. You may remember him as the man who scares the crap out of us every time he comes onto the show. He's going to go more than just the FUD about Heartbleed. He's not going to talk just about how it works or how it's been exploited. He's going to show you how you detect it and how you defend against it. That's coming right up. But first, I thought now might be a good time to talk about the first sponsor of the Twilight Ride. And of course, it's RingCentral. You know them, you love them, they've been with us since the beginning. And you know what? They just sort of encapsulate what we're trying to do as we move people to the web. Now, when we built this studio, we decided to do as much as we could through the cloud, store our documents, hold our meetings, and we really didn't want a big PBX system sitting in the basement. So when Russell, our IT guy, said that we could get a cloud-based phone system through RingCentral, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain, and now RingCentral has launched meetings. So in addition to all that we love about RingCentral, receiving voicemail through our email, sending and receiving fax messages from our smartphones, the auto receptionist who greets our callers and announces employees and department extensions, now with meetings, we can host face-to-face meetings in high definition and share desktop or documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Meetings makes RingCentral the single best business solution on the planet today. Now, here's what we want you to do. We want you to try RingCentral. See if maybe it can do for you what it did for us. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 a month per user. Now, you can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. Once again, just in case AT&T is threatening not to buy your Spectrum, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. We welcome back to the show Mr. Raphael Mudge. He is the advanced penetration tester. That's right. He's the guy who shows you what you need to fix. Raphael, it is so good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back, Padre. It's a pleasure.
And well, you know, last time you were on, the last two times you were on, you absolutely scared the pants off of us. You showed us a pivot that just kind of boggled the mind. You showed us exactly what advanced persistent threats look like. And now we've got Heartbleed. Tell me, I know that you were away when the Heartbleed news broke, but you must have been busy the last 2 weeks.
I have been. March and April, I call it red teaming season. I go and support different exercises, provide red team support. And last week I was on in a 60-hour exercise, pretty exhausted. We heard about Heartbleed, but we were so busy. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'll look at it when I get back. And got back, and it's pretty interesting.
It is an interesting bug, but let me ask you this. And I can ask you because I know you're going to give me a measured response. You've got people in the media, especially the mainstream media, who are saying, oh, my God, this is the worst thing ever. This is the end of the Internet. We're all going to die. We're all going to explode. You have other people, especially tech pundits, who are saying this is so overblown. This ain't really a thing. No one should be worried about this at all. Where do you fall?
I probably fall somewhere in the middle. Now, I'm not going to say, like, oh, my God, this is the end of the world, and this is more important than your kid's first day of kindergarten, okay? But as far as bugs go, it's an information disclosure bug, okay? That itself is not as scary as, say, a remote code execution bug. That said, what's scary about this bug is how widespread it is. The library where the bug came from, OpenSSL, is used by a lot of things. And right now, people are fighting with the implications of what this means for their SSL certificates, for their SSL-enabled websites. But the implications go way beyond that, because anything that uses OpenSSL and that vulnerable version and responds to that heartbeat message is potentially vulnerable to leaking information that an attacker could use. Moreover, what information is leaked depends entirely on the application that is in use and the configuration of that system. So it's one of those bugs where widespread, and your implications vary by situation. So it's scary in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that scares people the most, which is the effect of the bug can differ so greatly. I mean, most of the time, I'll say I've practiced just to see what kind of information I could get. You get gibberish. But someone who's determined, someone who keeps attacking, can actually get some pretty interesting information off of system memory. Now, we've got a video here. We tried to explain in English as simply as we could what Heartbleed was, how it was created, how it works, and what it can do. So, Brian, if you can, take us to school. We want to talk about Heartbleed because it actually addresses something very, very basic in programming and something that's very important. It's all about sanitizing inputs. It's about
sanitizing your comments.
Well, sanitizing your code. You know,
yes,
you have to make sure that the data that you receive is what you expected.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, the writer of the piece of code in OpenSSL that is responsible for the Heartbleed bug didn't do that. Now, Brian, do you actually have a link for the GitHub that has all the OpenSSL code? While you get that up, let me really briefly state what's going on in the Heartbleed bug. So what we're talking about is the heartbeat. Anytime I established a secure connection, so Snubs, let's say that you're Facebook. Okay, you're the Facebook server. I'm talking to you. You know how that little, you get that little padlock in the upper corner
yes.
of your browser?
Mm-hmm.
It tells you that you're secure, right?
Yeah. It tells me I'm using HTTPS.
Exactly. I've Secure Sockets Layer or TLS, mm-hmm. which gives me an encrypted tunnel between the client and the server. You're the
right.
server, I'm the client. Now, that's a good thing, because without that, anyone could just snoop in on our conversations
right.
and they could read everything that I'm sending and everything that you're sending back to me.
Especially if they have a Wi-Fi pineapple.
Brought to you by Hack 5. No, but but see, here's the thing. I can't just keep those open.
Right.
Right. Once I've established one of those connections, I need a way to tell the server that even when I'm not using it, let's say I'm reading something that's on my page and I'm reading it for 3 minutes, my client, my computer, still needs to be able to tell the server, I'm still connected, I still need you, don't shut off the connection.
So this is the heartbeat that's
this is
going
the heartbeat.
Between us.
Right. It's a nonsense piece of data. It's a minimal data set. It's a very small handshake, very small packet, essentially saying, keep me alive.
Okay.
Keep me alive. Keep me alive. And it does that every once in a while.
So why do we have these jelly beans up here?
Okay, so this is your system memory. You're the server, right?
Oh, yeah.
Don't eat your memory.
I won't eat my memory.
Man, just gonna eat all the memory. All right, so
my
hard
drive just failed.
Now this one jelly bean. This is my heartbeat packet.
Okay,
so what I have to do is I have to send you two things. I have to send you my payload, and the payload is the jelly bean, mm-hmm. right? But I also have to send you a description of how big this is.
Ah, okay.
So in all non-open SSL implementations of SSL, of the secure sockets layer, of the encryption, whenever I, the client, send something to you, the server, you check what you received against what I told you I sent.
Ah, okay.
So let's say I do this. I go ahead and I say, I'm sending you one jelly bean. I give it to you.
I just received one jelly bean.
Right? And that's it. And so you said, well, you told me that you sent me one jelly bean.
It
looks like a jelly bean. And now you send it back to me.
I'm sending you one jelly bean.
And there we go. So now the connection stays alive. If I did this, I am sending you five jelly beans. And I give that to you. What do you think you as a server do?
I only have one jelly bean.
That's it. Right.
This is odd.
It'll kill the connection, right? Or it'll ask for the heartbeat again.
Right.
That's simple checking, right? That's sanitizing your inputs. That's making sure that you've actually received what you expected to receive. That's good
that
coding.
That makes sense. Yeah.
There's a bug in OpenSSL.
No.
Yeah. And Brian, if you go ahead and bring up that GitHub, it'll actually show you the code that goes behind SSL. Now go ahead and forward. What line was that? We need you to go to line 3972. Right there. See? So you see where it says read type and payload length first. These next four lines of code, actually three lines after the comment, are entirely responsible for the Heartbleed bug. Now, let me explain. This looks kind of crazy, but let me explain what's here. HB type is just setting the type of data.
Okay.
So that's like from C#, that just says this is the kind of data I'm going to be receiving.
Okay.
P++, we've seen that. It's incrementing the counter. So it's plus one, right?
Plus one, yeah.
Now, here's the big line. NS2, which is calling a function, because we know it's in parentheses, right? So
right.
it's calling a function, and it's passing it two parameters. P is the location. It's called a pointer
of the payload, the jelly bean. So it's telling it where the jelly bean is located.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Payload is the length. That's me telling you I'm passing you one jelly bean.
Ah.
Okay? Oh. Now, a good piece of code would have had an extra line here that says, is P, the length of P, equal to the length of payload?
Right, yeah.
Right? So if I told
it
you...
It would be sanitizing their code.
It's sanitizing the code, sanitizing the input. It's saying, if I told you I'm giving you one jelly bean, what is P? Okay. How long is P? Is P actually one jelly bean? If it is, allow it. If it's not, then X. Kill the connection.
And since they didn't do that, there is no line that says if it's this long, then it should equal P.
Right.
That
right.
pretty much means that the payload could be as long as they want.
Or short. So this or is how short. It works. If you come back to me, now we're talking about this jelly bean, all right? So I'm still talking to you in the server, and I'm passing you this one jelly bean, mm-hmm. and I'm saying, I sent you 64,000 jelly beans.
It looks like 64,000 jelly beans.
That's how OpenSSL works. Because it doesn't check, it's just going to trust me. And unfortunately, that's not good. So what it's going to do is it's going to say, well, he must have sent me 64,000 jelly beans, so I'm going to send him back the one jelly bean plus 63,999 jelly beans he shouldn't have received.
So
which
bad.
Means I take your system memory.
Hello, hacks.
And it's all for me.
Oh, that's bad.
Hello, hacks. Exactly. and see, the problem with that is they can do it over and over and over, and each time they'll get a different set of the memory until they can put it all together and they can essentially have everything.
And from the server end, everything looks cool, so nobody ever checks for any difference.
To the server end, if you're using OpenSSL, the unpatched version, all it knows is that someone's sending a lot of heartbeats. And that's normal because that's how we keep the connection open. Mm-hmm. It doesn't realize that it's giving away the keys to the kingdom every time it sends you that 64K.
Authorization acknowledged.
Precisely, exactly. We got a computer fault.
Yes.
So that's how Heartbleed works. And go back to that code, Brian. This is the crazy part. This is what we're trying to drill into you people. When you're writing your code, you got to make sure to check for things like that.
Right.
This was an innocent mistake. This was, again, we know that this was submitted something like, what was it, an hour or two before midnight 2 years ago, December 2011.
Right.
So it was probably some guy staying up late, writing some code. It looked right, it worked right, but he never actually made sure that he was receiving was supposed to receive.
Oh, man, I feel bad for that guy.
I feel bad for him, but, you know, simple mistake that anyone could make.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate, but it's a good example of what can happen if you don't sanitize.
Very good example.
I want to thank Snob Shannon Morse for being with me on Coding 101 to explain that. But let me throw this over to you, Raphael, because now we know where Heartbleed came from. We know the code that enables this bug to happen. Tell me, what have you started to see as far as its effect?
Okay, in terms of effect, first off, I think the response on this particular bug has been really good. I think the way that it was passed on to certain large providers first, like Cloudflare, Amazon, and others, saying, hey, guys, just so you know, there's this SSL bug, giving them time to fix it and look at it before it went public was good. The public awareness is pretty good. And the last statistic I saw was that most of the top websites have had this fixed. Like the top 500, nobody's vulnerable to it anymore. And in like the top million, you're looking at like 2.5% or something like that, which is a pretty good response. In terms of its effect, well, remember earlier when this bug came out, everybody was really worried. Like, oh my God, the SSL keys. What do we do about the SSL keys? Well, today in the news, it came out that in targeted attacks, you're starting to see actors take advantage of this bug to break into VPN sessions. Okay, so you're starting to see, it's awesome. I'm an attacker. Defend is good. No, but you're starting to see other uses of this bug. Okay, hey, where else is this? How can it be taken advantage of? And I think over the next few weeks or months, you're going to start seeing more and more kind of corner cases, more and more, oh, I didn't know that was possible. Oops, kinds of things related to Heartbleed.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that I've seen in my inbox recently. I'm getting all these emails from major enterprise equipment vendors who have been reassuring me that their gear's not vulnerable, or download this firmware patch and it will take care of the OpenSSL bug. The funny thing is, not a lot of people paid attention to that because we were so focused on servers. Like you said, we wanted to make sure Facebook and Yahoo and Microsoft servers were all taken care of before we actually started worrying about whether or not our individual gear might have that Heartbleed bug. As you said, I think we're going to see that more and more. Now, I do want to throw in one story here and bring the boys back in, because if we start looking at what Heartbleed is actually costing us, we have now, just a week and a half later, a really good example of what it does. This comes to us from Wired. They spoke to people over at Cloudflare. As you said, they were one of the first to get word about this bug. And Cloudflare has been tracking activity from some of the certificate authorities. Specifically, they were tracking Global Sign to see what effect Heartbleed had on their network resources. What they found was that because Global Sign had to update their CRL, that's the certificate revocation list, it's a very small file that browsers can get from them that say what certificates are no longer valid, what certificates should you pull out of your lists. Well, that CRL grew from 22 kilobytes before Heartbleed to 4.9 megabytes after Heartbleed. That doesn't sound like a lot until you realize how many millions of times the list is going to be downloaded. The number of revoked certificates grew from 1,492 to 133,243. Now, the update caused a spike in requests for that CRL. All the browsers were going to Global Sign asking if I could get your list to find out if I have any vulnerable certificates. Now, if we say that traffic typically costs about $10 per megabit per second, just the traffic from the CRL list alone would have cost Global Sign $400,000 since 10 days ago. Now, that's one provider, that's one certificate authority, and that's not even over. That's just the revocation list. That's not new certificates. Cheever, let me bring you in here. This is kind of a nightmare, right? Because certificate authorities don't typically get this much traffic, and now legitimate requests for the CRL are almost acting like a distributed denial of service attack against Global Sign's own servers.
Oops.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the color commentary, Chibert.
No, this is, And the problem is, it's not like you can go after a hacker or someone that had created a malicious code. It was a mistake. And there's really only one description for it, and that's oops. It's caused an awful lot of people to go take an awful, much, much harder look at their infrastructure. And, you know, there's been a bunch of people in the chat room saying, you know, how do you find it if there's no logs? And I said, you know, realistically, the only way I can see it is if you had something like an InfiniStream, you know, just sucking down this metadata so that you can actually look at it at a later date. And I'll lay even odds. In fact, if someone in authority in Canada is willing to take this bet, I'll lay even odds they caught that person that grabbed all that information through using something like an InfiniStream, something that's recording all the connections that's coming through their infrastructure. I'll put a 20 on that one.
Now, Rafael, I want to throw that to you in a bit, because last week we talked about how the Canadian Revenue Service supposedly caught someone who was using Heartbleed to siphon records off of their network. But before we get to that, I want to throw the same question over to Curtis. Curtis, when we start to look at the actual business/financial toll that Heartbleed is going to take on the enterprise, there is going to be a lot of bandwidth costs. And we already know that. I mean, it's going to be substantial, especially if you're a certificate authority. There's going to be a lot of costs that go into IT departments to make sure everything is patched. We haven't even started looking at any potential damages from data that may have leaked over the last, 26 months, right?
Right. And that's the thing. You know, people are getting very upset. But the fact is that to a great extent, any security damage that was done by Heartbleed is done. I mean, that horse is well and truly out of the barn, across the county line into the next state. It's done. That doesn't mean that the costs are going to slow down. And for a company, whether they're a certificate authority or someone else, these are costs that can't really be delayed. I mean, think about this certificate authority. For a lot of online costs, most companies, let's say they do a promotion, people try to get into their servers because the promotion has been more successful than the company thought. They can throttle bandwidth. They can delay people. They can do all sorts of things. Something like this, you can't just tell customers, well, we know there's a huge problem, but you're just going to have to wait your turn before you get a remediation. You've got to answer the call. This is going to be huge. It's going to last for a while. And in many cases, it's going to echo up and down throughout the organization, hitting just about every part that deals with the public, deals with IT, deals with regulators, or deals with tallying up the cost for all these other departments.
Fantastic. Now, when we come back, Raphael, can I ask you about the Canadian hacker, the first real published use of the Heartbleed bug? Does that sound like a conversation we can have?
In what sense? I mean, I know as much as anybody else from reading the news story, and that's about it.
See, you say that, but then I see that smirk, and I don't believe you. Now, when we come back, we're going to go more in-depth into the Heartbleed bug. But now I thought maybe it would be a good point to take a break, to pause, and to thank the second sponsor of the Twiat Riot. That's LegalZoom.com. Now, modern technology is great. Smartphones, iPads, laptops, desktops, pretty much everything that we have, all the flashy, shiny gadgets, they help us to get things done. But with all this tech and all the services around us, why is it that our lives seem to be busier at the same time? Maybe it's because even though we're surrounded by tech and besieged by services, too much of it demands that we work around it instead of conforming to the way that we want to do businesses. LegalZoom gets that. That's why when it comes to getting the legal help you need, LegalZoom provides a great solution that works within your busy schedule. Let's face it, the legal system is complicated. There are better things that you can do with your time. Thankfully, LegalZoom is there for you. So if you're thinking about starting a business, forming an LLC, or getting a trademark, will, or living trust, LegalZoom gets the job done right. You'll get the personal attention that you need, and they'll help take care of all the details. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help services, but it's not a law firm. LegalZoom has been helping families and small business owners for 14 years, and they received an A-plus from the Better Business Bureau. So here's what we want you to do, you and the Twiat Riot. Visit LegalZoom.com now and use the offer code ENTERPRISE to save on your legal needs and also get access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. Don't put off the things that you need to do. Go to LegalZoom.com now and use the offer code ENTERPRISE. That's LegalZoom.com, offer code ENTERPRISE to receive $10 off at checkout. And we thank LegalZoom for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Raphael, let's get into it. One of the things that we talked about last week is this that Canadian hacker. So someone, they say, use the Heartbleed bug to get into the Canadian revenue system and remove, although we don't really know what that means, they actually did say remove, not copy, 900 social insurance numbers. Now, let's put that past us for a second. We know it's possible. I want to know from you, Chibert alluded to this, in what way would it have been possible to track this guy down? We know that heartbeats are not logged, especially when the exploit was just announced. So how would they have known they were even under attack? How would they have known it was Heartbleed? And how would they have known who it was?
Okay, sure. Let's take this one at a time. So organizations that have a target on their back generally tend to keep full packet captures, maybe up to 72 hours, depending on what they're capable of doing. And what that enables them to do, as soon as they have an indicator, something that they're worried about, like, okay, we know this kind of attack has this signature, they're able to go back and look at that last 72 hours of captured data and say, does anything that's talked to our network, does anything match those indicators? And if I were the owner of a site that had just gotten the notification about this attack, one of the first things I would do is go through that full packet capture and say, has anybody tried to use this against my organization, my customers, my users? Once I have that information, if I am a government like the Canadian IRS, what I would do is then say, oh, okay, here's an IP address of somebody who talked to me. And if that person didn't take many steps to cover their tracks, maybe they're just running the freely available code to pull stuff via Heartbleed. Well, it's not that hard to go to their nation's police force and say, hey, guys, got an IP address and a timestamp, have at it. And so I assume that's kind of the chain of events that took place for that capture.
I love the image of that last step, because I think a lot of us who live in the digital world forget that, yeah, you know what? They don't absolutely need every digital fingerprint. Sometimes they can just send the police to our house and find us.
One other note, though, about that, Padre, I think that's going to be really important to address. In a moment, I'm going to demonstrate the Heartbleed attack against a server I set up, okay? And I'm going to do it with publicly available code. But in line with that that Canadian IRS situation, please keep in mind that if you run this program against somebody else's server, a server that you don't control, you could be breaking the law of the country you're in, and you could end up in the same kind of situation that Canadian hacker ended up in. So please do keep that in mind. Definitely the things we're going to show you, run that on servers you control only. It's not cute or funny to do it otherwise.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we got a little bit of that after the last time you were on, where people were saying, why do you have Raphael on? All he does is sell tools to the bad guy. That's not what you do. What you're doing is you're giving us the penetration testing tools to test against our own services. If we don't know where the vulnerabilities are, we can't fix them. And that's what you're going to show us in this next segment. So lead us in. Let's put ourselves in that mythical 10,000-seat enterprise network again. I've got services everywhere. I've got services on-premise. I've got servers in colos around the world. What would I do? What would be the steps I would have to take to start testing all of the different services I have open to see if they're vulnerable to this bug?
Okay, that's good. That's a good segue. If we could put up my lovely laptop over here on screen, and my 10,000-seat enterprise happens to have two Linux boxes. A little disappointing. Okay, so first off, there is publicly available code to test for the Heartbleed bug. And I'm going to pull up a terminal here real quick, and I'll just show you what to Google for. The first thing that you've probably seen around is this piece of code written in Python by a guy named Jared Stafford. And you can see that Jared disclaims any copyright to this particular code. This is a very crude piece of code to test for the Heartbleed problem. What I'm going to recommend that you do is, instead of using this SSL test Python code, I'm going to recommend that you use the Metasploit framework to test for this particular problem. So here on Kali Linux, I've updated myself to the latest version of Metasploit, and I've pulled up my open source tool called Armitage to control Metasploit through. And earlier, I scanned my network and found two systems with web servers, okay? And all I did was I went to hosts, nmap scan, and I just did a quick scan looking across my network, and here are the two hosts that popped up. Now, if I right-click and go to services, you can see I know a lot of different services are open here, but for now, let's focus on the website element.
Right.
And you can see that 192.168.1.113 is running Apache 2.2.1.4, and 192.168.1.114 is running Apache 2.2.8. Okay.
Now, we have to say, Raphael, that this is a very simple thing that you did here. You just enumerated a network, and from the description, I can already tell whether or not it's going to be vulnerable to the Heartbleed bug, because if I see that version that's vulnerable, I know I'm in.
Actually, what I would say is the Heartbleed bug is based on the version of OpenSSL that was used when, or was present when Apache was compiled, based on whatever the package manager did. So it's not as easy as that. The best way to test, and because this is an easy bug to test for, is to actually test it, you know, just actually try to take advantage of it. And let me show you how to do that. So I've got two servers here. So there's a Metasploit module now. If you could show my full screen or pan over to the left.
I don't think I can. This is all that I'm getting through Skype.
Okay, don't worry about it. I'm going to do it for you.
Sorry.
Look at that. How cool is that?
Bam. Right?
It's teamwork. That's what I call it. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to search for Heartbleed. Okay? Oops. Let's go back to that. There we go. And what you're going to see is that there are two Metasploit framework modules. There's Auxiliary Server SSL, OpenSSL Heartbleed. Okay, this is a module we can use to test our different servers if they are vulnerable to the Heartbleed bug. So let's go ahead and do it. First things first, I'm going to just go ahead and drag this module onto the second Linux box there. And what I want to point out is we can configure what port it should talk to and which host, okay? Mm-hmm. And by default, it's going to look at port 443, which is our SSL-enabled web service. So let's go ahead and hit launch. And it's going to go ahead and fire away and just give it a minute. And it's going to come back and say, scan one of one hosts. And that's its way of telling me, none of those are vulnerable. Sorry, too bad.
Good.
Now, let's go ahead and drag onto 192.168.113, press launch, and let's see what happens. And we get back that indeed that there was a Heartbleed response with a leak. We've got something that's vulnerable. So that tells me that's a server I need to patch. Now, we're going to go in a moment, the implications of this, and we're going to actually take advantage of this bug to get back sensitive data, okay?
Right.
Because I'm one of the people, I like to actually demonstrate risk. I like to see the problem for real before I take anything at anybody's word, particularly all the journalists who've covered this.
Right. So, the tool says that it's vulnerable, but in order to prove that it's vulnerable, we're actually going to have to attack it. Now, folks, again, I cannot stress enough, especially if you just came into the podcast, he's doing this against his own boxes. He owns these boxes. He's not doing this out in the wild. He's not doing it to somebody else. Raphael?
Yeah, absolutely. I just set these up today because I want to demonstrate the problem without going to jail. And I don't want anybody on your show to go to jail either.
Jail bad.
I love the Twilight Riot.
Jail bad. Jail bad.
Jail bad. Yes. Okay. One other thing that I want to point out. So we just focused on, for example, our SSL-enabled web servers, okay? Well, that is not the only place this particular problem can occur, even when you're talking server-side. So let me take you into this module a little bit deeper. Let me drag this module over here. And you can see there's some other options we can set. For example, we can change the port, and we can change... let me just come back over here, services. Other services use SSL, for example, SMTP. It's possible in the SMTP program to issue a start TLS command to say, hey, start transport layer security, so now that our communication going forward is secured with SSL, okay? So if I'm running a SMTP server that's compiled with a vulnerable version of OpenSSL, then it might be possible to leak information, and that's dangerous as well. So you can actually drag this module over, change the port, and set start TLS to a value for the protocol that you're interested in looking at. And the options in Metasploit are SMTP, Jabber, FTP, IMAP, and POP3. So let me go ahead now, just change this SMTP, and same drill, hit launch. And this is going to connect to this mail server on 192.168.1.113, issue a start TLS command, and try to do the Heartbleed. And here you can see same response, nothing came back. So this particular module is not detecting this vulnerability, okay? So those are some steps you can take to start testing for that bug. Now, would you like to see this bug in action?
Yes, please.
Okay, let's do it. So we know 192.168.113 is potentially vulnerable. So let's go ahead and go there with our browser. And earlier, I created a form, okay? This form is on this SSL-protected website, https://192.168.1.113. And I'm going to do this from another system. I'm going to log in with the user Padre.
Oh!
And I need a cool password. Padre, what's a good password so you know I'm not making anything up?
Cranky Hippo.
Let's do that. I'm going to just, from my other system here, Cranky Hippo. And I'm going to press Submit Query. And I just issued a login from my other system that you can't see with Cranky Hippo. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use this SSL test program to connect to that server and try to pull back data with the Heartbleed problem. And I'm going to make my terminal just a little bit smaller here so you can capture the whole thing. And let's just come up here. And all I have to do to run this is just give it the actual server I want to connect to. Again, it has to be my server, not somebody else's.
Right. I don't think we can say that enough.
Because this is so easy to do and the data you could get back could be very sensitive.
It's tempting. I know it's tempting, folks, but don't do it if you don't own the box, please.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and just run this. And because that particular server is vulnerable to this attack.
That's the memory dump.
It's a memory dump. It's, in this case, 64K worth of data. And what you can see here is whatever was in memory of that particular Apache instance I hit. And it's kind of like going to a slot machine. I don't know what I'm going to get. I just know I'm going to get 64K of data each time. So just keep pulling that lever. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try this a couple of times to see if we get lucky and we get back that Cranky Hippo information. And there we go. The second time's a charm.
Oh, no.
Remember, I hit that web server from a different client, okay? I logged in with Cranky Hippo to HTTPS or SSL-enabled website. And let me know if you can see this up in the Twilight right here. But there we go.
Oh, no, we see it.
User Padre.
It's right there.
And the password Cranky Hippo.
It's clear text because it's pulling it straight out of memory.
Yeah, and keep in mind, this is the Heartbleed bug in action. Because there's only me hitting that particular web server, there's not a lot of data to potentially get back. I mean, if you had thousands of users hitting that, what I get back each time, it could be anything.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you were pulling the handle on a slot machine that only had one prize. But if this was an actual server in the wild, it would be filled with all sorts of active data, usernames and passwords and encryption keys. Wow.
Yeah, and actually, to kind of hammer that home a little bit, I'd like to show you. This is a tweet from Mark Lohman a couple days ago. And what he did is he, or somebody, I don't know if it was him, so I don't want to get Mark in trouble here, but he has a screenshot of this attack several days ago being run against one of Yahoo's mail servers and showing how he was able to, same kind of thing, pull back a username and a password for somebody who recently logged in just before that request was issued, okay? So this is a very serious problem. There is potential for somebody to pull back your sensitive data, but when there's a lot of users, it's not really possible to target a user. You just keep pulling that slot machine over and over again and see what you can get.
Yeah, you don't need a specific user if you're getting all the users.
Right. It's pretty scary. And until I set up a lab about 2 hours ago to play with it more, I was convinced that there was a problem. I was just surprised by the reliability of getting sensitive information back. It's pretty scary.
Yeah. Because the honeypot that I did, I did get clear text data from the memory buffer. But obviously the script that I wrote wasn't as advanced as yours. Most of the time it required a lot of serious analysis before I could turn it into anything usable. The fact that you were able to get a plain text memory dump. Wow. Okay. I'm kind of blown away now. Let me bring in the other guys really quickly before we jump into an ad. Chibert and Curtis, now that you see this, now that you see how easy this was and how Raphael was able to code this into the pen testing tool, is this a demo that you think enterprise execs should see to see how vulnerable their networks could be if they don't patch OpenSSL?
Who are you,
Padre,
asking?
I'll go ahead and say absolutely.
Go.
This is the sort of thing that every executive of a company who's been asking why they should care about this ought to see, because it really does lay it out in very plain, very precise terms and shows, hey, it doesn't matter what you think is going on. Look at how easy this is.
Yeah. Actually, Chibert, let me give that over to you. This is like my nightmare. This is a script kiddie tool that is incredibly easy to code if you don't get one of the modules that are already on available on the internet, and gives you results almost immediately. Most ScriptKiddie tools require at least a little bit of skill to figure it out. This is a no-brainer, right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I've been getting a lot of emails from friends saying, you know, I've had a sudden uptick in the amount of spam that's being generated from my email account. I wonder why.
Yeah. All right, Raphael, when we come back, I don't want to let go of Heartbleed just yet. I do want to figure out how it is that you write these modules, how it is that you imagine how this is actually going to look when you build these interfaces. And then you've got to talk to us about a very interesting organization that's bringing up the next generation of defense experts. But before we do that, let's take one more break to talk about the last sponsor of the Twilight Riot, and that's TechServe. Now, we know Apple is a big part of the enterprise, but we don't touch on them that much in This Week in Enterprise Tech. I mean, even though BYOD is big, it's sometimes difficult to figure out how Apple fits into the overall scheme, which is why we love the fact that TechServe is one of our sponsors. Businesses keep coming up with creative ways to service their customers, increase productivity among employees, and make more money with the same resources, all by using the iPad. For example, the Institute of Culinary Education equips students, faculty, and chefs with the iPad, empowering them to do away with heavy and unwieldy textbooks and streamlining the learning process. A major cable service provider in the Northwest gave its field technicians, who are the public face of the company, iPads that have been configured to provide better customer service to customers. And retail companies have enhanced their in-store customer experience by using the iPad, not just as a point-of-sale device, but also as a spot where customers can learn about sales, special offers, and upcoming events. These clients and more have turned to TechServe, the country's largest Apple reseller that sells, supports, and manages the largest iPad deployments in the world to manage their iPad projects. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with an experienced partner? TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple solutions, as well as solutions from Avid, Adobe, and more, throughout the United States. No matter if you're just starting your iPad deployment or getting started as a business, TechServe can help. Now, right now, TechServe is offering a complimentary download just for Twilight listeners who are deploying iPads or who are interested in learning more about doing so. Go to techserve.com/twiet-7sins. That's techserve.com/twiet-7sins to get access to the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment and see the common pitfalls that throw companies for a loop during their iPad projects. That complimentary download is available right now just for Twilight listeners at TechServe.com/Twilight-7sins. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Raphael, I'm still kind of reeling from that demo of how easy you made it look, but I want to get a little bit into your mind. When you hear about a new exploit, or when you're finding new exploits, what goes through your mind? What's the process for coding a penetration testing tool for it?
Okay, sure. So when I see an attack that's interesting, I mean, first thing I might try to do is, you know, implement it. Like, first, in the case of Heartbleed, there was a public POC, a proof of concept, we call it, and the popular one that's really made the rounds, and I apologize to the author, I have to look again to get his name right. But Jared Stafford's code helped a lot. Because one of the things, an attack is not real to people until they see it. So that's why a proof of concept is so important. So Jared Stafford provided a starting point, some simple Python code anybody could look at and say, okay, let me prove to you that this problem is real. Now, in the case of what's in Metasploit, I didn't actually develop that module. If you can zoom over here to my screen again real quick and put that up, what I want to show you is about within 24 hours of Heartbleed being announced, there was a module in the Metasploit framework repository. And Metasploit is that open source project, the largest public collection of offensive capability out there. And this project is managed by Rapid7. The Heartbleed module itself had 10 people contribute to it. And within 24 hours, there was this capability for us to, in a turnkey way, check if our servers are vulnerable. It's really good work on the part of that community. But what's really cool about that work is it's ongoing. What I want to show you is this is a Git pull request for improvements to the Heartbleed module. This is ongoing work that's happening right now. One of the complaints about Jared Stafford's code is that it only supports certain kinds of hard-coded key sizes and cipher suites, okay? So if the server you're trying to test doesn't respond to that, it's going to look like it's not vulnerable, even though it may be. And so what the Metasploit framework community is working on right now is making that particular module far more robust and capable of really detecting this vulnerability when it's present, not just in a few common cases. So for the most part, the module is accurate. The statistic I heard was 97% accurate is what those default values are good for. But they're working on expanding it, and I think that's really cool work.
Yeah. Well, Raphael, we are running out of time, and I didn't want to leave before we had a chance to talk about this. I'm going to call them a cyber extracurricular. I know that's not actually what they're called, but that's what I feel they are. Tell us about this group that you've been involved with. And actually, Chibert, I think you've been involved with them too, right?
Yes, I have. In fact, I've been working with some of his proteges.
Ooh, okay. Uh-oh. Raphael, lay it on us.
Okay, so for a lot of people, Christmas is the most wonderful time of year. And for me, it's March and April because this is CCDC season. And CCDC is the Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition. And if you could put up my screen, I actually have an image I'd like to show the Twilight Riot while I speak to this.
Wow.
And what this is, just like there's March Madness for the basketball, that is the sport that's happening in March, right? I don't pay attention.
It's the sports ball, yeah.
The Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition, what it is college students form into teams, and they show up at a regional event where they square off against 10 other college-level teams. And whichever team can best defend a network, keep a business running, and respond to business injects, simulated business value types of things, progresses on to the national championship event in San Antonio, Texas. And that's actually happening this coming week in San Antonio. The event's been going on. This is its 9th year. And this is my 7th year involved with it as a volunteer. And I'm pretty excited about it. They're doing a lot to bring up the next generation. And something that happened to me, I mentioned last week I was at an event. Do you remember how I did DNS communication as a demo shows ago?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, a lot of the students know that my tools are used during CCDC. Well, one of the student teams actually found a way to disrupt my tools by modifying their DNS server to make it randomize the replies in a way that didn't break the DNS query but broke my malware.
Wow.
And it took me a little bit to figure this out. But once I did, I have a compiler. I have source code. I know how to use it. I was able to make a change to continue using my tools. And they delayed me by a good 3 hours with that. But that's one of the reasons I do CCDC and other events like it, is because the things these students do to stop us, the red team, it's really ingenious. And it's really rewarding working with them, seeing them grow. And as much as I like to think we challenge them, seeing what they do to challenge us. Nice. So that's coming up. People can learn more about it at nationalccdc.org. It's a wonderful organization. If there's an opportunity for anybody in your audience to get involved with it, it's a volunteer at their region, I highly encourage it. Just fantastic organization.
Yeah, at the very least, you got to know these teams. You got to know these people because these are the security experts of the future. Now, let me ask you a quick point of clarification. So your red team, is there only one red team?
No, each region. So there's 10
regions. Oh, each region has a red team. Okay.
Each region has a red team. And I've been on the Northeast region since 2008, back before I could even hack a watermelon. So that's a whole other story. But there's several regions, and each region is run, I don't want to say autonomous, but they're mostly autonomous. They're volunteer run, and the organization overall is provided guidance by, I want to say it's University of Texas San Antonio, an organization they have there called CIAS, which I think it's the Center for Information Assurance and Security. Jessica Archer, if I got that wrong, please don't be mad at me. I just love talking about CCDC.
But, now, for the odds makers out there, and you with inside information, who would you put your money on?
Oh, okay. So this year is really interesting because a lot of the teams that made it to the Nationals, it's their first time. So a lot of the it's been shaken up quite a bit. Two of the teams that did really well last year. So RIT, the Rochester Institute of Technology, always a very strong team. They placed first last year. I expect a strong showing from them. Just to kind of give you an idea of what goes into this event, the entire RIT team stayed at school during spring break and did nothing but drill through their five-minute plans. They have checklists of what they do when they sit down at an unsecure system to secure it. And they just did nothing but drill through them till it's muscle memory. So I expect them to do very well. And I also expect the Air Force Academy to do very well as well. I think they placed second last year or the year before. And their cybersecurity team is just amazing. Just an amazing effort by those cadets. Those are the kinds of people you want going into national security in their career. I'm very proud of them. And we'll see how they do.
Fantastic. Now, Rafael, I'm sorry. We have way run out of time. In fact, we've run way over time. But can I do this? Can we invite you back a few weeks after the competition? I'm sure you're going to have some really, really good takeaways from exploits that people have used, from methods and processes that you haven't seen before. And I think that might be good to share with the Twilight Riot.
I would love to come back. And I would also suggest that we get somebody on from the Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition so they can kind of give their word on the event as well, because I've been working with these folks for several years. They're wonderful people. Their heart is 100% into this, and they would be just fantastic guests to have on this show.
Rafael Mudge, advancedpentester.com. Now, do you want to tell the Twilight Riot really quickly, what is it that you're doing? Aside from this competition, where can they reach you? Where can they find out more about you? Where can they follow you on Twitter? This is your 60 seconds. Go.
Okay, since I have 60 seconds, Twyatt, buy my stuff.
I like direct. Direct is good.
Only if it suits your needs, though, because I do vet people. And if my software isn't for their use case, I tell them.
Right.
No, actually, okay, so I run a company, Washington, D.C.-based company, Strategic Cyber. I develop penetration testing software to execute targeted attacks, to actually find out how susceptible you are to sophisticated attacks, find out how well your defenses hold up. You can learn more about that at www.advancedpentest.com. You can catch me on Twitter as Armitage Hacker, and I blog about once a week at blog.strategiccyber.com. And yeah, that's about it. Check out the software. And if you want to get the kind of the gateway drug, try out Armitage on Kali Linux. That's the little sister to Cobalt Strike.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rafael Mudge, the Armitage Hacker, our personal guru for all things security. Thank you so very much for coming back on. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Padre. It's a pleasure. Pleasure being here. I love it. Thank you.
Now, also, we've got our panelists, our fantastic panelists. We don't have Twyatt without Curtis and Chibert. Curtis, let's start with you. I know that you were also involved in the competition. I know that you're also raising the next generation of security experts. But maybe you want to tell the Twyatt Riot what they should be paying attention to in the next week.
Well, we've got a couple of things. As always, come on over to Enterprise Efficiency. Got some great articles, a wonderful community over there. We'd love to have your voice in it. And is something just a little bit different. If you're interested in complicated things, patterns, and stuff made out of string, my dear wife has just published her first book. Head over to www.braidweaver.com to check it out. It is really neat stuff.
Speaking of things made out of string, Chibert, what's up?
Well, I've got all kinds of projects, but I want to give a shout out to some of my students, Summer and Decker and Tony, who would just be dying to go to San Antonio and actually participate, but I'm not sure if they're pulling it off this year. But what I was going to do is say to Rafael, hey, I've been looking at trying to build black team infrastructure in the cloud so that you can have a black team that is distributed around the globe. Get those running and then pull it down into a private cloud and go at it, blue team. Yay, blue.
Yay, blue team. Gentlemen, thank you so very much. You know how much I loves you. And you know who else I loves? I loves you. That's right. The loyal watcher, the listener, the person who downloads each week of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Without you, we wouldn't have a show. So to you, I say a heart bleed thank you. Now, we want to do something for you. We want to make it easy for you to get every episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech on your device of choice. So go to our show page at twit.tv. And /twit. There you'll be able to find our RSS feed. You'll find the way to get this show onto every device of choice. Your iPad, your iPhone, your Android tablet or phone, your laptop, your desktop, Mac or PC. It doesn't matter. We give you all the choices so that you can get the goodness on your hotness automatically. Also, did you know that we actually have a YouTube channel? Yeah, if you go to youtube.com/Twiat, you'll find all of our episodes. And we've started to break out individual segments, like that fantastic demo from Raphael Mudge. That's going to be available as a segment in case you want to show it to your executive. You want to bring it to your CTO, your CIO. You want to bring it to your class and say, hey, folks, this is really how easy it is. It's part of the things that we're going to be doing to make it easier to bring a little bit of enterprise into your life. Also, why not follow me on Twitter? You can find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll see what we're doing in every episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. You'll be able to suggest topics for future episodes, and you'll be able to find out what I do in between my shows, which I'm actually doing quite a few here on the Twit TV network. You can also follow us live, that's right, every Monday, although right now it's Friday. So normally every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time, you can find us at live.twit.tv. Follow us before the show, and you can see all the foibles, all the fun that goes into making a live Twit TV show. And as long as you're going to watch us live, why not join us in the chat room? You may hear I occasionally call out to people in the chat room because it's filled with just some wonderful people, some of the smartest engineers, some of the funniest trolls, and just the greatness that is the Twit Army. Finally, I want to thank everyone here who made this show possible, to Lisa, to Leo, to Carson, my super producer, and to my TD, who more and more often seems to be this man by the name of Brian Cranky Hippo Burnett. Brian, do you want to tell the audience maybe where they can find you on Twit TV?
Well, Padre, I don't have an extra input, so I'm not going to show myself, but they can find me doing know-how with you on Thursdays at 11 o'clock.
Yeah. Come join us. Until the next time, I'm Father Robert Palliser saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Ah, my beans!